And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. With the events in Charlottesville, Virginia as our fulcrum, we'll examine the persistence of white supremacy and white nationalism. How is it that its poison still courses through America's bloodstream? And how the Trump White House is providing the transfusions that breed new life into fascism. Well, Public Enemy and we are still fighting the powers that be. And now with us is Professor of Comparative and Foreign Law at Yale Law School. His book include Harsh Justice, The Origins of Reasonable Doubt, and The Verdict of Battle, Hitler's American Model, The United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law, James Whitman. In Hitler's American Model, Whitman looks at the ultimate ugly irony that when Nazis rejected American practices, it was sometimes not because they found them too enlightened, but too harsh. James Whitman, your book is stunningly, painfully well-timed against the vivid and deadly reemergence of fascist mayhem and death in Charlottesville.
It sure turned out to be more timely than I would have expected or certainly hoped.
Well, educate. Nazism really triumphed in Germany during the high era of Jim Crow laws in the United States. Did the American regime of racial oppression in any way really inspire the Nazis?
I think it did. The research that I did actually shocked me. I didn't expect to find what I found, but I found exactly that. Inspiration and influence, I should say, particularly on the Nuremberg Laws of 1935. It's important to emphasize at the beginning that the Holocaust was not yet on the horizon in the early 30s when Hitler first seized power. The Nazis had different goals in mind, the goals you find in the Nuremberg Laws. They wanted to create some form of second-class citizenship for the Jews and ban sex and marriage between Jews and what they regarded as pure racial Germans. Those programs were programs for which you could find plenty of material, as they called it, in American law, and they studied American law carefully.
Now, we should say that the Nuremberg Laws, for people who may not know them, were really the centerpiece of anti-Jewish legislation of the Nazi regime.
They were. That's exactly right. They were sufficiently notorious that people at least may have heard the name. I imagine they have. The Nuremberg Laws really were the first big step on the road to what eventually became the Holocaust, but which was what was not at the moment the Holocaust at that time, as I said.
Well, you show that the Nuremberg Laws were crafted in an atmosphere of considerable attention to the precedents of American race laws. American race laws had to offer. German praised American practices. Already found in Hitler's Mein Kampf was continuous throughout the early 1930s. The most radical Nazi lawyers were eager advocates of the use of American models. So tell us more about, for example, Jim Crow segregation laws and what they had to do with and influence and why they appealed to or how they appealed to Nazi radicals.
Sure. First of all, you're exactly right. Hitler in Mein Kampf described the United States as the one state that was making progress toward the creation of a healthy race order, if you can imagine. In fact, that's how I began the research. I pulled Mein Kampf off the shelf and found that line and wondered what more there might be to be found. And boy, was there a lot to be found in the sources. You're also right that it was particularly the radicals, the most vicious faction of the Nazis, who were the greatest supporters of American models, who wanted to bring American law to Germany. Part of what interested them, of course, was the thing that we remember about that period, namely Jim Crow segregation. But it's a mistake to imagine that that's all there was to it. They certainly were interested in segregation, although what we discover when we look at the sources is that the radical Nazis in particular regarded Jim Crow segregation as inappropriate for German circumstances. As one of them said in 1934, Jim Crow segregation is a program that can work with American blacks because they're already oppressed. But the Jews in Germany, so he went on, the Jews in Germany are too rich and powerful. We have to use harsher measures than Jim Crow. Other Nazis were in favor of bringing Jim Crow in as a as they regarded it as a relatively mild form of establishing a racist order in Germany. But when they looked at the United States, they saw other things than Jim Crow. And in fact, the most important forms of American inspiration involved other kinds of law. And the first thing you have to remember here is something that we very easily forget, namely that American racist legislation in the early 20th century extended far beyond Jim Crow segregation. You know, we think of the history of American racism, our sense of what took place was formed very much by the experience of the civil rights era, which was, of course, directed fundamentally against segregation, against separate water fountains and all the rest of the horror of segregation. But as Nazis looked at America in the 1930s, they saw a much wider range of racist programs and racist legislation, and racist legislation that extended far beyond the racist South. What Hitler was praising in Mein Kampf in particular was American immigration law. American immigration law, which was pretty much expressly race-based. It was designed to keep undesirable races out. That's law essentially from the 1920s, although some of it extends back to anti-Asian measures in the late 19th century. American immigration law was, of course, not law that emanated from the South. That was national legislation. And as I just suggested, it wasn't directed exclusively or even primarily against African Americans. It was directed against Asians. It was directed against Eastern Europeans. The Nazis found that extraordinarily interesting, as other far right-wingers did too. American immigration law was a subject of discussion, a topic for praise for European far right-wingers for decades, really, before Hitler came to power. American immigration law was only part of it, though. American law also included exactly what the Nazis were looking for in the Nuremberg Laws, forms of second-class citizenship. Again, some of those forms of second-class citizenship involved in particular the black population, especially in the South, in particular through measures like poll taxes and literacy tests. African-Americans were denied the meaningful right to vote. That's something we're seeing again today. But as a matter of law, full citizenship rights of African-Americans couldn't be denied to them because the 14th Amendment guaranteed their citizenship. But there were other populations for whom American law had created forms of second-class citizenship of great interest to the Nazis. These included in particular Native Americans down until 1924, and especially, entirely forgotten today, Filipinos. After the U.S. conquered the Philippines in 1898, the Supreme Court consented to the creation of a form of second-class citizenship for them, calling them non-citizen nationals. That's a term that the Nazis would use once again for the Jews. All of those forms of law extended far beyond the segregationist South. The U.S., from the Nazi point of view, and in reality, was a much, much wider-ranging, broader-based racist order than that. But the kind of American law that really inspired the Nazis most, and especially the radicals, was anti-miscegenation law. That is, law banning and sometimes criminalizing and threatening harsh punishment for interracial marriage. Anti-miscegenation law, once again, was not confined to the South, and it wasn't just about African Americans. 30 states had anti-miscegenation statutes. Many of them were directed against Asians and a variety of other populations, Native Americans, once again. And it was especially these anti-miscegenation statutes that excited Nazi radicals and the Nazis more broadly, and it's their influence that we can see most directly on the Nuremberg Laws.
The Nazis had a shared commitment, your book shows, of white supremacy, in part because they realized that it had been successful in helping create America's dynamism, especially its economic power. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, that's exactly what they thought. I hope they were wrong in thinking it, of course. But one of the reasons, inevitably, that the Nazis were interested in the American model or in American models is that the U.S. then, as now, was the dominant power in the world. Hitler wanted to create a Germany that was also going to be the dominant power in the world. And when the Nazis asked themselves what it was that had powered America's rise, inevitably they pointed to American racism. What else could it have been? Now, some of them were certainly pessimistic about the future of U.S. power. They thought that eventually race mixing would destroy the United States, although Hitler himself was unusually optimistic about the future of the U.S., especially in the early 1930s. In the late 1930s, things began to shift. But certainly when the Nazis looked at the U.S., they saw what they thought was not only a racist order, but a hugely successful racist order. The model of the U.S. also mattered to them a great deal because the U.S. was a land-based empire. They were thrilled by the history of the U.S. conquest of the West. In particular, when and periods after the periods that I discuss in my book, when the Nazis moved into Eastern Europe in the horrific period of the early 1940s, the period of the Holocaust, many Nazis, Hitler included, often invoked the American conquest of the West and the American, well, near extermination of Native Americans as a model for what they were doing, too. The U.S. was the great land empire, and one whose success, the Nazis were convinced, had to do with its ruthless program of establishing white supremacy across the continent.
And the American Immigration Act of 1924, which conditioned entry into the United States on race-based tables of national origins, earned particular praise of Hitler in Mein Kampf. Relate more about that to us.
There was first a statute in 1921, and then, as you say, the Immigration Act of 1924, which was based on, both were based on national quota systems. The purpose of these statutes was to limit immigration, especially from Eastern Europe, and to favor what Americans regarded as the compatible races, that is, not only the English, but also the Germans, and other Northern European Scandinavians, exactly the groups, of course, that would constitute what Hitler imagined to be the ruling races of the world. The same sorts of purposes, the same idea of what counted as a desirable race, as a strong race, lay in the background of those statutes. In 1921 and especially 1924, their aim, among other things, was to keep out Eastern European Jews, of course. The Nazis were aware of that. As I say, there was a prehistory of all of this. In the 19th century, anti-immigration measures directed particularly against Asians. That's something we see not only in the United States, but in other parts of the English-speaking world, like Australia in particular, another model to some extent for the Nazis. In the 19th century, we begin to see a tremendous panic in these parts of the globe that have been settled by the British about the appearance of Chinese and later Japanese, a tremendous desire to keep out those undesirables, if I can put the term in quotes. That long tradition reemerged in a big way in 1924, and the national quota system established in 1924 lasted in the United States until it was repealed in 1965, but the repeal was put into full effect only in 1968, so until the very end of the civil rights era. American immigration law was dominated by these more or less unapologetically racist attitudes right throughout most of the 20th century, the first two-thirds of the 20th century. It's worth emphasizing in talking about Hitler's admiration for those statutes, something that I think shouldn't be surprising, but it's easily forgotten, how much the Nazi movement and other far right-wing movements resemble current right-wing movements in putting opposition to open immigration at the core of their program.
And we can go back even further than that. One of the things that had been pointed out was in a speech given by Hitler in 1928, of course, he looked admiringly at the United States for the beginning with the extermination of Native Americans.
He did. It's really depressing to read this stuff, I gotta say. Yeah, he gave a speech in which he spoke admiringly of the Americans for having, if I can remember the phrase, gunned down the millions of Redskins to a few hundred thousand and confined the remainder in camps where they could be watched. And then went on to say that Europeans had better do the same thing if they were ever going to have any hope of competing with the Americans.
And I still think that this is a powerful, critical, important book to read, Hitler's American Model, the United States, and the Making of Nazi Race Law. If anyone still doubts America's ongoing racism and status and really leader of the pack, consider our country's blood laws. And I want you to go back and talk more about that. The Nazis considered Jews as vectors of mongrelization, but much of America was infected with the same race madness.
Sure was. And it's here on this topic in particular that we see the phenomenon that you mentioned before, Nazis finding American law too harsh. One of the things that Nazis found most intriguing, if not always perfectly inspiring about American law, was the American law for classifying who belonged to what race. This is, of course, a problem. I mean, there are mixed-race people who appear before court, and there are always questions about which race they should be classified as belonging to. America had some extraordinarily harsh classification law. The most famous example is the one-drop rule, which you find in some states, not all. That is the rule that any person with one drop of black blood counted as black. But there were a whole variety of other means of determining who counted as a member of the disfavored race or disfavored races, once again, especially blacks in this case. There were also a variety of techniques that courts used, sometimes kind of seat-of-the-pants improvisatory ways of deciding that a litigant before the court was actually black or actually white. This stuff in the United States was naturally of great interest to the Nazis, and they studied it quite carefully, I should say. We have a remarkable stenographic transcript of a planning meeting for the Nuremberg Laws in 1934, which began when the Minister of Justice presented a memo on American law and involved a great deal of discussion of American law, and in particular, these questions in American law, how to classify individuals. But the Nazis themselves thought that this American law went much too far. They described the one-drop rule, if you can imagine that, as inhumane. Mm. You can't do that to people. It's not fair. Their own system for classifying who counted as a Jew, as it emerged after the Nuremberg Laws, only definitively characterized persons as Jews if they had three Jewish grandparents. If they had two Jewish grandparents, they were only classified as Jews if they practiced Judaism or married another Jew. That, by American standards, was an extraordinarily mild approach. That is a less far-reaching definition of who belonged to the disfavored race than you could find in basically any of the U.S. states that had anti-miscegenation statutes. And that's really quite a remarkable testimony to the nastiness of American law.
And popular Nazi magazines actually praised lynching as the natural resistance of the Volk to an alien race that is attempting to gain the upper hand.
That is it exactly. I mean, I'll tell you, the book turns out to be much more timely. I handed in the final version of this book on the eve of Election Day. I had no idea that we would see violence in the U.S. that looked like the kind of violence the Nazis were praising, but you're exactly right. They produced propaganda articles which praised lynching, at least American lynching, and that the Nazis themselves thought that the state should be doing those kinds of things, not private parties. So lynching of the American kind is another thing the Nazis were not eager to import. But exactly as you say, they regarded it as the healthy response of the folk to the presence of an alien race trying to get the upper hand. It's really appalling to read these things.
So the similarity between the Ku Klux Klan and fascist paramilitary groups like the Brown Shirts compared to the post-Reconstruction order in the South to the Nazi system. So your motivation in writing this book, and in your mind, why is it so powerful and important to know this as we confront the latest episodes of violence perpetrated by neo-Nazis, by white nationalists, by white supremacists in Charlottesville?
Well, it's first of all, of course, essential that we realize that white supremacy is not a foreign import into the United States. It's an indigenous product. We've had it for a very, very long time. We must remember that. It's not that somebody read about Hitler and, reverse of the pattern I've been describing, experienced a flash of inspiration and decided to bring the same thing to the U.S. We pioneered a lot of this stuff going very, very far back. It's also essential that we engaged in these white supremacist practices in the U.S. without ever abandoning our democratic institutions, without ever abandoning our American Constitution. That's very, very important. What it means is that those institutions, in fact, let me go a step further than that. As you try to understand what it was that the Nazis found so inspiring about American law, one thing that you discover is that the white supremacist legislation and the court decisions that I've described were the product of the American common law and the product of our political process. We have a system of law which is unusually open to strong political influence, in particular extremist political influence. You see this very much in American criminal justice today, in which tough-on-crime platforms pushed by politicians make their way into the practice of criminal justice in a way that doesn't happen in other countries. The Nazis, far from rejecting our American forms of political democracy and the American common law, admired those things. That really seems to me to deserve a lot of emphasis, because we tend to think, as we see horrific events like the events in Charlottesville, that the greatest danger we face is the danger of the loss of our democratic institutions, of what we think of as traditional common law liberty. That's a mistake. Those institutions are in some ways wonderful and have had produced magnificent results sometimes, but they also lend themselves to some of the nightmarish practices that the Nazis admired. So Nazism, or let me put it in the American terms, white supremacy is not only not alien to our society, it's in a fundamental way not alien to the way our institutions work, and that means we've got to take a really hard look at the way we do things in the U.S.
And the book helps us do that so much. It's one of the most engrossing and disturbing pieces of legal history I've read in a long time.
Urge
all of our listeners to do so. Hitler's American Model, the United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law. Professor James Whitman, thanks for spending some time with us this morning.
Thank you very much. See me stumble. Don't stand back and look on.
My sisters and brother New Yorkers did give their hands to struggle. For the last 3 days, they have been out in force at Trump Towers. So let's hear from some of our fellow New Yorkers who I recorded declaring to Trump, "You have blood on your hands," in protest at Trump Towers. Let me ask you, you're carrying a drive-out Trump.
The Trump-Pence regime refused fascism.
The irony for some of us of being next to Cartier, Neiman Marcus, Bergdorf Goodman, Tiffany, and there's Trump Tower. Okay. So what does all this mean?
If the people of Germany had recognized what was coming decades ago, they would have taken to the streets. They didn't say anything when they came for people who were different than them. What's happening in this country is exactly what happened with the rise of fascism and the Nazis. It's really, really terrifying. I'm embarrassed that the white supremacist calls my city his home. We hate him here. We want him out. He is a danger to this country. He is a danger to the world. He is a danger to the planet. He is a danger to civilization in its entirety.
And what borough or what city did you come from today?
I live in Washington Heights in Manhattan, and I am thrilled to see that our numbers are growing and growing. What happened in Charlottesville over the last couple of days is bringing the alt-right out of the closet, and people are recognizing that they are nothing more than white supremacist thugs, many of them rich business people. We must declare that the alt-right is nothing more than unsheathed KKK white supremacists, and the United States of America, the good people of our democracy, will have none of it.
And you are?
My name is Laura Moore.
Thank you, Laura.
Rise up, people of the world, rise up. Rise up, people of the world, rise up. Rise up.
Ho, ho. Donald Trump has got to go. You blew the sound bite.
I'm sorry.
Well, okay, you have another chance. Well, let me ask you. After what happened in Charlottesville, what is your message today?
Ultimately, what happened was a white supremacist attack. We need to weed out white supremacism in all our institutions and all the stratas of the U.S. economy and system.
And you see the connectedness between the anti-immigrant activity, rhetoric, and policy, and the anti-Muslim policy and rhetoric, and what happened in Charlottesville?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, racist speeches and racist attacks and whatnot sort of lean into all together. For example, the majority of Muslims in the USA are black. So anti-Muslim speech is generally anti-black speech. So it's not necessarily coded or any of that. It's pure, blatant, racist, anti-blackness, anti-immigrant, anti-people of color. It's just white supremacist speech. I mean, he has Gorka, he has Bannon. People around him are generally white supremacists. So it's not like it's not something special. It's not something new. He's not hiding the fact that he's a white supremacist and that the people around him are, and that he fully condones them.
And do you mind telling me what borough you're from and who you are?
I'm from Hell's Kitchen. My name's Omar Gwayan. I'm a PhD student over at NYU.
Thanks for speaking with WBAI Radio.
Thank you very much.
USA! Black people! No hatred in the USA!
To attack anyone who stands against them.
Yeah.
And so we remember Heather Heyer today, and we thank her for her righteous work. And she is a hero. And to the Trump and Pence regime and its supporters, we say no. There's blood on your hands, and we vow to organize to stop this.
And our hero is, that you were referencing?
Heather Heyer.
Tell us about her.
Heather Heyer was murdered yesterday by a white supremacist who intentionally drove a car into a crowd of protesters who were righteously counter-protesting a KKK rally.
And let me understand, does your family, do your friends similar to you take such umbrage and feel as furious as well you should, but at this white supremacist, neo-Nazi, hate-mongering effort that is clearly licensed by the President of the United States?
Well, my friends and family are all the people who came out here today in this city and in cities around the country to stand up against this, and I'm very proud to be part of this.
And what area of the city are you from?
I'm from Brooklyn.
Great. Do you mind telling us who you are?
Sure, my name is... Well, is this for an interview, a media?
Yes, it's WBAI Radio.
Oh, I love WBAI. Okay, this is Eva Sahana.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We refuse to accept
a fascist America.
A fascist America.
In the name of humanity.
In the name of humanity.
No.
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 Drive out.
Drive out.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.